Yeah, I thought that was, I was like, this is really bad. I mean, now I can realize this is her. This is bad. But then I really didn't know even how worse it was going to get, because then they put me in a body cast after that.
From Linkly, it's How I Got Here. The stories behind the youth, high school, college, and professional sports journey, where it leads, and what we learn along the way. I'm Corey Koski, and on today's show, Kevin Warren, the Chief Operating Officer of the Minnesota Vikings. In 2015, Kevin Warren became the first African-American Chief Operating Officer of an NFL team. He's a lawyer by trade and got his first job in the NFL in 1997, when he was hired by Dick Vermeil in a legal front office position. He earned a Super Bowl ring with the Rams in 1999. In 2001, Warren joined the Detroit Lions as a Senior Vice President of Business Operations and General Counsel. Following his time with the Lions, Warren returned to Phoenix, where he worked for an international law firm, Greenberg and Traurig. In this role, Warren represented the Wolf family and the Minnesota Vikings ownership group in what became a successful $600 million deal to purchase the Minnesota Vikings. After representing the Vikings' new ownership group in their purchase of the team, the Vikings then hired Warren as their Chief Vice President of Legal Affairs and Chief Administrative Officer in 2005. This is his story. Born and raised in Phoenix, Arizona. Now tell me what your childhood was like and what it was like growing up out there.
Yeah, so Phoenix, if you spend a little time there, it's a beautiful place. The weather's always good and dry, heat. But as far as my childhood is concerned, I was born in a neighborhood called South Phoenix, and it basically is predominantly, majority, African-American. But it provided me some really good role models growing up. And ironically, on my street, I lived on 2131 East Valley Drive in Phoenix. Our family house that I grew up in was, in the last couple of years, named as one of the 20 historical African-American homes buildings in the state of Arizona. And because of my parents, both of them were educators. My mother was, she had a rough life growing up. She was mixed. Her father was African-American soldier at Fort Huachuca in Arizona. Her mom was, my grandmother was a maid from Guadalajara, Jalisco, Mexico, and actually cleaned at the Army base, and that's how they met. But my mom didn't get her college degree till she was about 41. She went back to school after she had me in her early 40s, and ended up becoming a librarian, but was just a woman of faith and probably, the most charitable person that I've ever met. I think that's where some of the charitable instincts that I have were really just observing her. And then my father was African-American, born in Marlin, Texas, moved to Arizona when he was 9 months old, and had a wonderful career, but had a lot of heartache too, because he ended up being one of the first African-Americans to get his PhD from Arizona State. But because of racial-related issues, really didn't get a chance to be a professor until later, much later in life than he should have. But so because of that, he was an elementary school teacher and an elementary school principal. But when you ask about the way I was raised, I'm the youngest of seven kids. There's a 20-year age gap, so my oldest brother is 20 years older than me, and he was one of the first African-American scholarship football players at Stanford. But so I had a really good childhood, and a very demanding household. Academics was paramount, respect still. To the day that my parents died, I have never called them by their first name, but it was yes sir, and no ma'am, and yes ma'am. And even my in-laws to this day, I still call them, Mr. and Mrs. Spears. So my household was very disciplined, and my parents were right, wrong, or indifferent, they were hard on us, and academics was first, and probably even higher than academics was the way that we treated people. Neighbors and school teachers. So your nightmare day would be that if a teacher or someone, an elder at your school or church or in your community made a comment that, you were either flippant or smart aleck or said something that you shouldn't said to them, and they called your parents, that was not a good day. But right across the street from our house, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad actually lived there. And so you had all these little small homes that range from probably 800 square feet to, I think our house was 1300 square feet, that raised seven kids, to he had a 6,000, 7,000 square foot home with gates around it. But he had emphysema. And so one of the reasons why he spent a lot of time in Arizona and not in Chicago was due to the dry weather. But I bring that up because it created a certain kind of aura in our neighborhood. You know, Cassius Clay, before he came, Muhammad Ali would come and visit. And then I noticed that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I mean, he was over our house a lot because we lived right across the street, and he had great respect for my dad and vice versa. But he would walk up and down our street for hours throughout the day. And I remember as a young kid pointing out to my mom, like, you know, boy, they're really in the exercise. They walk all the time and meet. And my mom was just straight bullet person. She was like, no, their house is probably bugged, and that's why they do it. And so I say that to say, and when Malcolm X was assassinated, we slept on mattresses on our floor for weeks because people were coming up and down the street shooting and all that. So it was a great place to be from. But in around fifth grade, it got to the point where our neighborhood became very, very dangerous with crime and drugs. And then my dad made the determination that we were going to move to Tempe for a better life. And my mom really fought him on it, was upset because one of my sisters was going into her senior year. And my mom said, this is not a good time. We got to be respectful. And he just said, you know, I got to make sure Kevin lives. And so he said, you can either come with me, and if you don't want to, Maryland, want to stay in the neighborhood, God bless you. But Kevin and I got to move on. He's got to get into a school that, you know, gives him a better chance to succeed, but really primarily from a neighborhood. And so we all ended up moving, and that's how we ended up in Tempe.
So when does playing you sports, when do you sports become a picture in this setting?
Really from day one. I mean, I just probably like most of us, if we're similar in age, you know, we didn't have the distractions that a lot of young people have today as far as, you know, in our home. We had two televisions. I mean, we only had three bedrooms. All the boys slept in one room, and we had trundle beds, and then the girls slept in another room, and then my parents slept in another room. And then we had a family room and a kitchen. But there was a television in the family room, and my parents had a television in their room. So we didn't have the distractions. I mean, we had a very rigid household. And so, I mean, you knew. During the school year, you went to school. You came home. You did your homework before you went out and played. And sports became very important at that age. Weekends, you got up early. You did all your chores. I mean, we washed the cars. I mean, hand wash. I tell my kids that now, and they look at me like I'm crazy. You know, we actually hand washed the car with a hose and scrubbed the tires with Ajax and, you know, wiped them out and vacuumed. And so by the time you cut the yard and hand washed the cars and cleaned your room and vacuumed did all of the cleaning and laundry, it was probably 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which would give you a couple hours. But so sports was an outlet, but my family is very athletic. My dad played football at Arizona State, was, you know, voted one of the 50 greatest players there, then having my older siblings and some phenomenal athletes in our neighborhood. But that was really a mechanism. When we went out and, you know, go play, that's what we did. We played sports, pick up basketball and baseball. And
so it wasn't organized?
Not organized. And that's what I think it made it special. I remember as a kid, I was about ready to get a serious spanking because I hit a baseball through our front window. And literally, Honorable Elijah Muhammad was walking across the street to see my father when I hit the ball. Uh-huh. And when it went through the window, my parents was like, you know, this is time right now. And I remember him talking my parents off the ledge and saying, you know, leave this young boy alone. He's just out here trying to have fun with his friends. I remember that vividly. So we went from, I mean, baseball to the basketball to football to whatever, you know, we could do.
Maybe talk about when you got struck by the car and how that impacted your life.
Yeah, so as a kid, you know, sports was really important. And I would say probably around fourth or fifth grade, I started making it a goal to be able to play college sports. Because, again, I was very blessed. My oldest brother, he set the tone in our family. And to have an older brother, I didn't understand the magnitude of if you had an older brother who played football at Stanford. Because you figure he played at Stanford. He was there 61 to 65. I was born in 63. And so his career was actually almost over by the time I was born because he tore his ACL. But even then, just growing up, you know, the lore that you would hear about, you know, the siblings, you know, in my family, my brother was, you know, All-State and All-American in high school, probably a better baseball player than he was football, and for sure would have played Major League Baseball or pro football, but for getting injured. And then I had a brother who was a state championship wrestler and two other brothers who was outstanding football players. So sports was really important to me. So even probably about a fourth grader is when I said, I want to play college sports and, you know, earn a scholarship. And so I was coming into my own. We had just moved to Tempe, new neighborhood, new area, new friends, and just kind of getting settled. And then, you know, I'd done it 100 times. It was our second summer in Tempe, but I was going up to our local high school where I ended up going to high school to play sports with my friend, you know, pick up basketball, pick up football, and ended up getting run over by a car. And I vividly remember the accident because I was, you know, did everything the right way, rode my bike on the sidewalk, but I just remember the sound of the screeching of the tires is what really got my attention. And I said to myself, you know, either I'm about ready to get hit or it's something that's really, really close, because it sounded, you know, very close. And then I remember at the last moment I was able to look down and saw the, you know, the impact with the car. And then how the good Lord probably shuts your brain down. I don't remember anything from the actual impact of the accident. And then I woke up when I landed. So it was almost, you know, for that time period of floating in the air and whatever happened. And then I woke up on the ground. And so that's when it, you know, the pain started to come on. And I remember a lot of people were standing around and telling people to get away. I can stand up. I was could be okay. And then that's when I looked down at my leg and see that it was had been, you know, injured badly, among other things. But that was the most prominent one. But I've said it many times, that was probably the start of my life, because up until then, you know, I didn't know that there was a differential. I knew that there were people that I would see that probably had more financial resources than us, but I didn't know them, because everybody in our neighborhood either lived on our street, and we all, you know, didn't have resources. We had, you know, one car. I mean, when I grew up in a family, we had one car. We shared the car. It was no, you know, big deal. And I remember it was a big deal, like when my parents bought my siblings another car. But yeah, I was in a bedroom with a bunch of other people in my family, but we ate well, and we took a family vacation to California. So I didn't know what we did not have. And so that's why that accident, I wouldn't say I was spoiled, but that accident really helped me to mature and grow up. And so after the accident, you know, having to be in the hospital and being traction, I keep a picture on my desk over there for a time period. But then, and I was like, this is really bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, now I can realize this is hurt. This is bad. But then I really didn't know even how worse it was going to get, because then they put me in a body cast after that. And that's when I really realized how injured I was. But that's when I also really emotionally, mentally, spiritually, that I really struggled. That was a real hard. Being in the hospital was bad enough. Being away from your parents and you know, being injured and, you know, concerned if you're going to walk again. You know, you never know if anything's going to heal. Just the uncertainty. But at least I could manage. I couldn't move out of the bed. But when they put me in that body cast, I literally thought I was going to lose my mind. Mm-hmm. And as I look back at now, no one really took the time to try to educate. It's not anyone's fault, mm-hmm. but educate, like, what you were getting ready to go through. It was just like, okay, we got to put you in a body cast.
How long were you in a body cast for?
A long period of time, and months, and that was really hard. To all of a sudden, and that was the age. You know, you're 12 year old. And then now, all of a sudden, you know, you're in a body cast, you're going to the bathroom. And I tell people all the time, you know, when people say they've been flat on their back, I have been. Mm-hmm. And if you just, I said it the other day in a speech I gave at the University mm-hmm. of Minnesota, is just spend one day, just take a Sunday, mm-hmm. and spend one day and eat, lay down and eat all of your meals, drink all of your fluids, you know, go to the bathroom, just for a day. And that was very difficult. You know, your digestion is off. Mm-hmm. You're going to the bathroom, it's demeaning. You're going in a bedpan. And now even I've talked about it with my other siblings. You know, there was no like counseling or mm-hmm. anything. I didn't. I mean, the pastor would mm-hmm. come and pray for me and stuff, but there wasn't like counseling of how to kind of deal with that when your body was growing. And mm-hmm. and the other thing was funny. I don't think anyone accounted for how much you grow as a teenager. Mm. So the cast that they put on me ended up getting like tight. Seems like right away. And my dad was very demanding, and I broke 6 back scratchers down in my cast. Yeah. But he was like, you're gonna have to suck it up until we, you know, take it off. But in retrospect, I knew I was gaining some weight for inactivity.
but it was, I was growing. And so all of those different things, dynamics. And,
so how did you deal with that?
You know what? I'm in the middle of writing a book on this now. I said it that I was at my lowest moment one morning, I remember, because I could hear the kids outside playing. And so my days, it's amazing how your body starts to hold on to certain, your mind and body and your spirit hold on to certain things. So I could tell when the sun was rising and the sun was setting. It was almost like, okay, that's the dawn of a new day. But I remember for one day in particular that I was really struggling, that just emotionally and mentally. I was literally about ready to lose my mind. I just felt that when does this end? The end is near. And then even when that ends, it really is just the beginning of the rehab process, which could be worse. But I remember hearing a bird, for the first couple time period in my body cast, when they brought me home in my bedroom, all I heard was all the things that made me sad. Mm-hmm. You know, I just heard the kids playing, having fun, cars driving by, people walking by, laughing, all these great things that I heard that I was missing out on. And just like any other traumatic part, that's why I'm really sensitive about not only the immediate love and support and prayer for people that go through things, but the continuance part. Because I had a whole bunch of friends that came by and family, you know, like for the first 2 weeks, everything was okay. And then all of a sudden they just drifted. And I remember one morning vividly, it's the first time that I really heard and focused on like a bird singing. Because, and that was like a sign to me that I'm moving past the pain. Mm-hmm. Because the first couple time period, all I was hearing was all the things that made me sad. And when I heard that bird, it was like the turning point in my life of, okay, this is, I'm gonna be okay because I'm starting to reconnect with, you know, reconnect with nature. And then I think where it really started when I finally got out the cast, talked to the doctors, you know, asked them what I could do to get better. And they told me swim. And I approached my parents about putting a pool in our yard and backyard. And they just said, we don't have the resources to do it, and didn't do it. And then I said, you know, I had a $32,000 settlement from the accident, and I ended up spending about $11,000 to build a pool in our backyard. And that's the name of my book, Build Your Own Pool. And because it was, you know, it's one thing to be passionate about something, and it's another thing to be passionate about it for it to move you, you know, to write a check. And even in that pool rehab, it taught me maturity, and that was at my lowest point. But one thing I learned about being in a swimming pool too is that for you to get to the top of the water, you got to push off from the bottom. And I think that so many times in life, people are halfway, you know, they're in a 10-foot pool and they're trying to elevate their life, you know, financially, spiritually, emotionally, whatever it is, by just going from 4 feet to the top, and you can't do it. You know, the way you really do it is you go to the bottom and use, you know, your strength to really push off to kind of get you to the top. And that was that when I bought that pool and spent the money on it and started the rehab and my time back, that was really when my life kind of changed for the better. And that's really when I felt the hand of God on me, that there were things that were planned for me if I would follow and do what I was supposed to do.
All right, so you get a college scholarship to play basketball. Mm-hmm. What did that look like?
You know what it looked, I was so focused on like recovery, is I ended up, that became part of my DNA. You know, at first it was like, I gotta get this weight off of me. I gotta get better just to recover. And that's when I started to really soak in the importance of every single day. I mean, that's what I really did. And I, as a kid growing up, I was one of those ones that as we got a little bit closer to the start of the school year, I would start focusing on kind of where we're having Thanksgiving dinner and what we're doing for Christmas holiday. And then at Christmas holiday, I'd be thinking about what we're doing for spring break, where we're going on summer vacation. And when I got summer vacation, I couldn't wait to get back to school. I never really relished, and I think that's one of the reasons why that accident happened, is because I never really relished in the moment. I was always looking over the horizon. And what that accident called me is just literally, let's focus on today, what we can do today. And that became my mantra in my recovery. It became my mantra in sports and academics. And then all of a sudden, before I knew it, I was like, man, I'm getting healthy. And I'm doing pretty good in sports. And I kept that same mentality. I just never stopped it. And I, you know, got to be a freshman. I was nothing special and played on a freshman team. And still had setbacks. You know, I loved baseball, but ended up getting cut from the baseball team. But kind of focused on basketball, played on the JV team. And then I kind of felt I might have a chance at college when during the playoffs in my sophomore year in high school, I was on the JV team, did really well, but then the coach pulled me up to varsity for the playoffs and get the dress. And that's why I'm so conscientious right now. You never really know these little things that may seem like little to people are can be a game changer. And when Coach McCuen pulled me aside after practice one day and said, hey, we're going to be in the playoffs, we had a really good team, and I want you to dress. Even warming up with the varsity really was the start for me the next year. And then I had a really good junior year. And during my junior year, ironically, we played the high school team from my old neighborhood. And my brother Morrison tells a great story, because I was the only one in the family who didn't graduate from South Mountain High School. Mm-hmm. So everyone else. So the perception was, okay, yeah, you're a Warren, but you know, you moved to Tempe now mm-hmm. in this posh neighborhood, which it was not posh, but a nice neighborhood, but you're a Warren, but you're not really a real Warren. And I remember we ended up playing South Mountain High School, who was really good. I think they were number one in the state, had some players that went on to play big time college. And we played them at Arizona State because we had made it to the Final Four and as a junior, and I had an absolute phenomenal game. And so that was really a special day, because that was kind of like the endorsement from my old neighborhood to say, you know, I remember them, we'd lost, they beat us, but them like standing up, you know, we were going off the court. It was a special day. And so I think once that deal had a really great senior year, and still today it bothers me, we were number one in the state mm-hmm. and ended up losing in the first round of the playoffs just because, you know, our team was not, you know, focused. And that, to this day, I still feel the pain. We should have won the state championship that year, but Westwood High School, you know, beat us. But then I got a chance to go on to the University of Pennsylvania and then finish my career at Grand Canyon University. And I think that's where it came together. But it, now that I look back, it came together basketball and academically. I stayed healthy, but it really came together because that's when my life spiritually came together. And so that's one of the things I really try to talk to my kids about all the time. You know, I was the same person, same mm-hmm. players that worked hard, but up until that time, you know, my life spiritually was, it was just misdirected.
What do you mean by that?
You know, it was interesting. I grew up in a household that we went to church every Sunday. If we were in town, we were in church every Sunday. There was no, just like Saturday. I mean, Sunday, it was none of this. I got a sore throat or, you know, got a baseball. We went to church every Sunday. You know, my parents, I remember the collection plate. My parents would, you know, write checks in the collection plate. I remember visiting my dad writing $25 check. But, and the church we went to, yeah, it was very a good Bible-based church. But I really didn't understand what it meant to have a true spiritual connection. And for someone to talk to me about tithing and about prayer and about fasting. And so I think part reason why I went through that journey at University of Pennsylvania, I knew that was the right thing to do, and I would, you know, find a local mm-hmm. church to be able to go to when it made sense. And then I stopped at Arizona State before I ended up at Grand Canyon. But Grand Canyon, because it was a Christian-based school, we had to take Old Testament and New Testament. And that was the first time that I truly understand, you know, got a chance to really understand what it really meant to have a relationship with Jesus Christ and make a commitment and the things that come along with it. Doesn't mean it's you're perfect. I've done you know, some of the stupidest things in the world, but at least it was really planted in me. And then when I grew spiritually, and I dedicated my life there at Grand Canyon, and so from then on I've just been on a journey. And when that happened, then my basketball took off and academics, you know, really took off. I stayed healthy, never missed one practice or one game in 2 years, and it was a really testament. I always thought you needed a 4-year career to go into your college Hall of Fame, and the Lord really showed me then I only had 2 years. I played there for 2 years and was able to be blessed to go into Hall of Fame and do well, but it was because everything came together.
So you have all these experience in sport, and you have these difficulties you go through at a young age, and now in your leadership position now, how has that impact on how you lead now and how that's impacted your path to get here?
You know, it's all of it. I mean, I think that's really what I rely upon is I love sports. I mean, I really do. And I really love more so what it means, and I love the people involved. And I think the thing I like about it the most is that it calls people to come together. And it doesn't matter when you get in practice or you're in a hard training session or you get in the game, it doesn't matter where you grow up, what your family's net worth is, what your academic background is. It just requires you to come together for common good, and it breaks down color barriers, sexual orientation, whatever the case may be, to come to good, to do the best we can, you know, to win a game. And so I think what it's taught me more so is that people are not robots. You know, people are people. And when people walk in this building here, yeah, we're here for a job to do, but people have personal stuff that they're going through. They have issues with their parents and their spouses and significant others, their partners, their children. Some of them have health-related issues. Some have financial issues. And I think what has helped me from a leadership standpoint is my sensitivity, is because I think probably if we took a poll in this building, everyone in here, whatever, if they made listed on a sheet of paper what's the thing that's troubling their soul the most, I have personally experienced that because I think of my upbringing. So whether it's you know, color related, because being a black person, if someone's dealing with, say, discrimination, I've been on that side of the fence. If someone's dealing with financial issues, I've been on that side of the fence. If someone's dealing with health issues, I've been there. Someone lost a parent. One of our major corporate partners lost their mom. The CEO lost their mom yesterday. I was able to call and reach out because I lost both of my parents. I mean, so those different things that happen. So I think from a leadership style, what I've tried to do is to create an environment, but to really lead with my heart and lead with people, to put people first, and to create an environment where people, no matter what they're going through, when they come here every day, that they feel comfortable, that this is a safe place for them and a place that they really enjoy and look forward to it, and to make sure that they know that they're taken care of.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show today. If you like this show or any other of our shows, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. If you want to read stories written by our guests, you can do that on www.linkly.com. Don't forget to sign up for our weekly newsletter so you don't miss any of these stories. Make sure to check out our social pages. We have them all: Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. If you have any suggestions for our show, please write us on Facebook. I'm Corey Koski, and you've been listening to How I Got Here from Linkly. Special thanks to Wade Beavers and our friends at the restaurant Agriculture.